It is Saturday, February 9th, 2008, 10:06 on the Central Coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, a bit of the Week in Geek News and your questions and comments of technology. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com. We are trying a new theme, D-Surf in A from Ubugogo. And it's not playing. All right, traditional theme. Okay, so that's the theme we've been using for about 8 years. We're thinking about switching to this theme. So do you have an opinion of our new theme? If so, let us know. Go to geekspeak.org and send us a note whether you like our old theme, our new theme, and tell us why. Welcome to GeekSpeak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KOSP. Today we're covering geek news. In the second half, we're taking your questions and comments. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877, or go to geekspeak.org to send us email right now. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks Sean Cleveland, Senior Technical Marketing Manager at NVIDIA. Morning, Sean.
Good morning, Lyle.
So your theme opinion, your mic wasn't up. I'm sorry.
I like Ubugogo.
Yeah.
Great band. If you go to myspace.com, Ubugogo Band.
Or just geekspeak.org.
We have a link there?
Last week's show we do.
And that song's actually off their latest album, which is, we listened to it.
I've been listening to it in my car. I like it a lot. There's some other stuff I might be using for the show, so I'm kind of excited. The cool thing about Ubugogo is that Justin Abini, I believe he's the drummer, but I'm not actually sure.
He's the bassist.
So he's been listening to GeekSpeak for a while, and whenever they play this song, touring and stuff, he's been thinking about GeekSpeak. So there's kind of a connection from an audience perspective.
Right. His name is Justin Abini.
Justin Abini. Thank you.
And, it's a really cool band. You know, what's interesting is we've been listening to Devo on the beginning of our show for a long time.
Yeah, we have.
And it's a great theme, and Devo's one of my favorite bands. So, it's really cool. But this music is very fresh.
Yeah.
And they have this Devo-like quality.
They do.
You know, just
it's
a little more.
It's in the spirit.
Yeah, it's definitely in the spirit, which I really like.
Yeah. Miles Elams, another geek student. Hi.
Good morning.
Good morning, Miles. So that's the old geeks in the room, me, Miles, Sean, and getting us a little fresher and younger, Ben Jaffe. Morning, Ben.
Fresher and younger?
Well, at least younger.
Morning, Lyle.
Morning. I didn't say immense intelligence or anything, but I could say that,
oh,
too.
Ouch.
In any case, we'll do the geek news first, and I'll start with Miles.
Recent survey conducted by Cisco Systems states that most users around the world believe that the internet is safer today than it was a few years back. And one thing they're finding is it's not necessarily true.
Right. They're just trusted more.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. There's this comfortability level. Things have become the status quo.
Everybody's
and people
doing
have,
it.
And because people have their antivirus software, they assume like, well, I'm protected. I have this, or I have some firewall software, so I'm protected. Therefore, the internet's safer.
So what's the reality?
Well, the reality is a bit more complex than that. For example, a security professional by the name of Bruce Schneier, has stated that there are two pieces of security that security professionals seem to be lacking at. There's the feeling of security, then there's the reality of security. And while security companies have been really good, for example, with antivirus software, firewall software, at the feeling of security, that which helps us sleep well at night, they've been fairly haphazard with regard to the reality of security, whether we are in fact secure. In fact, the inventor of the antivirus software has come out saying that security departments, by and large, are wasting their time. This is just a general security
Oh, I really wish Alex were online or on the air.
Yeah, because he's
but I mean, it's
because he's a security analyst,
right? Because talking about security, spending so much money, because there is a huge amount of money going mm-hmm. on for security. To say, okay, we're going to look for all these possible avenues for attack into a program. The inventor of the antivirus software likens it to saying you're sitting on top of a building looking down at traffic, and you see that you could fire an arrow at someone through their sunroof and hurt them. So that's a critical vulnerability. But how likely is that? How does that really help
how
you?
How likely is it that I would think about that on top of
right,
a building?
Think about,
it's pretty high.
It depends if you're Rambo or not.
Right. But think about if you're an auto manufacturer,
yeah.
would you
deal
want
with
to
that
spend
issue.
Money to make arrow-proof sunroof panels?
Right.
You know, something like that. And how much money would that cost? And would that actually improve security on a day-to-day basis?
And wait, are you saying that, I mean, how does that relate to the feeling of security? Like people drive in the cars, as soon as something like that happened in the news, then they'd feel very insecure and everyone would close their sunroofs.
Yeah, but if they sent enough arrows down...
Let's see.
Enough arrows?
You know, there are those chances that you can,
you can do a lot of damage.
That you can go to the wrong site or install the wrong piece of software and, you got hit by that arrow.
I see. So,
I mean, the threat
is
there.
I didn't make the analogy back, Sean. I'm
right,
like,
right.
Why are we talking about arrows and roofs? Right. So you're saying is there's so many attackers mm-hmm. that it doesn't, that the vulnerability
you know,
doesn't matter what.
Imagine an environment where someone is a security vulnerability specialist. They sit in top of a building and they put out a press release saying, look, vulnerability. And then you had the first auto manufacturer say, hey, we have arrow-proof sunroofs that track them and for an extra, $5,000
yes.
fee or the like. Suddenly had the snowball effect of people going, oh my God, an arrow could get me through the sunroof too.
Okay, but
that's kind of where the
and I guess yeah. I guess the thing is that the software vulnerabilities that we talk about that the press covers all the time, the general public doesn't understand them enough to understand if it's a protect yourself from flying arrows in your car or if it's something really real like these wheels fall off at high speeds.
Right.
So
they're spending huge.
So analysts
of money.
You're saying are yeah. spending a lot of time on these kind of abstract ideas instead of doing what? What is it that we're not dealing with that makes the internet so unsafe?
Well,
insecure.
For example, for a company, if you were spending $1 million on an antivirus upgrade and service that only reduces your chance of getting attacked by 2%, that's not as good as if you're spending $10,000 to make everyone in your company more aware of security vulnerabilities.
Right.
And that increases by 30%, for example. It's things like that. It's not saying security on or off. It's where are you spending your money and are you spending the money – are you spending $15,000 to get the arrow-proof sunroof and feeling
reasonable.
More secure that way? Or are you actually doing things that make you more secure?
Right.
And ignoring the arrow-proof sunroof.
Good point.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Miles.
You know, their study just came out from Symantec that they've seen a significant shift in spam trends. And now, for the third month in a row, more spam is coming from Europe than it is from the United States. And they think this is because of the increasing European broadband market, the fact that they have the capability to send more spam.
Interesting.
And a lot of spammers, they think, are based in Europe and are taking advantage of these new broadband capabilities. So,
What kind of increases are we talking about here? I mean, has it traditionally been domestic spam, or is it normally like some strange island somewhere that has some bandwidth and really lacks?
I don't think it really matters where the spam begins. It's really a matter of when people get infected, what kind of capabilities do they have to spread more spam? And it has to do with the broadband, the capabilities of the network that all these people are on. And it just so happens that Europe has more broadband capability
right.
than the United States does right now.
To be clear, what Sean is connecting spam with virus vulnerability stuff is that the biggest senders of spam are people's computers that are infected, and they're not even aware of it.
They're not even aware.
So
right.
you're saying in Europe, because the bandwidth is so high, a person's uninfected machine is
sending a lot more data. Yeah. It has capability to send a lot more because the bandwidth is there.
Cool.
So they don't really have – this story, unfortunately, doesn't have that
statistics.
Kind of, yeah.
But it does make sense. I mean, just – yeah, very much so. Let's go ahead and go to Ben for the next story. Ben?
Oh, it now accounts. Oh. It says the spam now accounts for 78.5% of all email traffic.
I believe that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Wow.
You know, I just set up a for a contract customer. I just set up a email address on their homepage, and I'm doing the thing that I've always talked about doing it, but I've never really done it, and that is you make temporary email addresses that you plan on only using for a few months, and you forward those to your main mail. So after a few months, you kill the email address. You put some kind of date in it, so when a person looks at the email and it starts to bounce, they realize, oh, it's a date-based thing, and they go back to the website and get a new one. And then on the autoresponder of that email, you add in a thing that says, this email address is temporary. Go back to our website to find the new one. And that will basically, once enough spam comes through that email address, you throw it away, and the real email address is never published to the internets. In any case, I just implemented that, and I think it's working, so it's kind of a nice trend.
Yeah.
So if you want to protect yourself and you've got a website, don't put an email address up there, and once you've already gotten spam on it, it doesn't matter. So that's kind of sad. Mm-hmm. Ben Jaffe.
Yeah, Microsoft and Yahoo. On February 1st, Microsoft offered $44.6 billion for Yahoo.
Wait, shouldn't the search engines be buying the software companies? I mean, Google could buy anybody they wanted, right?
I don't think they could buy Microsoft.
Microsoft can buy whoever they want, too. I mean, so Microsoft wants to compete with Google.
Wait, Yahoo's, you just made like a logical fallacy here. If Google can buy anybody they want and Microsoft can
something's wrong here. Yahoo should be, I mean, if they're a percentage of Google, they should still be ungodly.
That's any percentage of Google is ungodly. I like to play off the name Google, too. That's very clever.
Oh, nice.
Well, Microsoft bid was a hostile strike, wasn't it?
But it wasn't really hostile, Ben.
Not yet.
Yet. I'm flustered. Okay, so this morning, fresh, hot off the presses, Yahoo's board met yesterday, and they rejected Microsoft's bid.
Woohoo!
Yeah. So the $44.6 billion would turn out to be about $31 a share, and Yahoo says, we will not consider an offer below $40 a share. So now,
what was the share before Microsoft's offer?
I don't know. I should have looked that up. But so now the ball's in Microsoft's court, and
so now it could become hostile.
Do the math. $57.5 billion would be the next considered bid. Yeah.
Trump change for Microsoft.
Come on.
A few billion. Bill Gates could wiggle that out of his change purse.
Yeah. Well, so does Bill Gates want to?
No, that's a question. So I guess question is. Is Yahoo making any announcements of why they're turning it down? I mean, I don't think the financial reason's good enough because any of the investors are going to make, you know, straight cash out of this deal, which is going to be pretty effective. Or are they saying, you know, if Microsoft buys us, the way Microsoft runs business elements, within a few years, everybody will still have to use Yahoo, but it won't really work. I mean, is Yahoo making an announcement about it, or is there any inside leaks or anything about why they're turning it down?
I don't think they've said very much. Also, this story is just like 2 hours
old. I know,
old,
it's very impressive. You already have it, Ben.
Fresh youth. they basically said that $31 a share, quote, massively undervalues Yahoo, said the spokesperson. And it also, according to the article, doesn't account for the risks Yahoo would be taking by entering into an agreement that might be overturned by regulators.
It's true.
So the board is going to send the letter to Microsoft on Monday and say no and spell out their position. And
they'll say more money, please.
More money, please.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. There was a news announcement last week from Google that they're revamping their search engine. Mm-hmm. Did you hear about that?
Yeah.
So I think it's Google Experiment. So up until this point, the algorithms keep improving and search, engine keeps improving, but the interface has remained static. In fact, one professor from UC Berkeley, Marty Hurst, noted that if you compare Google search results listings today. To those that were available from InfoSeek in 1997, they're almost indistinguishable. I mean, you basically get 10 hyperlinked results from your search. So Google is actually, I guess they've made this available. You can sign up for this now. So instead of simply getting a list of links, you can now choose to see the results that are in a mapped, so that they're mapped or put on a timeline or narrowed down by informational filters. So we should look into this. It sounds very interesting. A new way of actually looking at your search results. And the timeline's interesting because it literally is a timeline across your screen. And you can see when those became available. So if you're looking for news,
It's a nice way to know.
When you get up to the latest piece of news.
Yeah, Google's has a lot of lab features that aren't always live. There's a few that I use every once in a while, and some of them are like this kind of additions, and it makes sense that they kind of incorporate them in the lab, which is kind of interesting. I can't recall the one I wanted to turn on. I think it had to do with keyboard shortcuts, so allowing to use your search wizard. They turned off in that environment, the beta kind of environment. They didn't have any of their advertising on it. Because I don't know why exactly. So I entered in this beta, and I'm using it for a long time, just a URL for Google instead, and no advertisements. So that's been kind of nice. I guess
really
with
cool.
a new launch of the search engine, they might be turning off.
I'm a big fan of iGoogle.
Beta. Yeah?
So if you go to iGoogle.com, it's their RSS news engine. And I have gathered RSS feeds from everywhere, and I put them in tabs. And you can create these new tabs, you know. And it's a great way of looking at news. I go there to look for all my news headlines.
Interesting.
And then I just open up the ones I want to read in new tabs, and then I go through and read them.
It's very much that portal idea from the mid-90s.
Works really well.
Yeah, and to find out more about all these things, labs.google.com, they've got a lot of really interesting stuff. They have a ride finder. They have a web accelerator. I'm not exactly sure what it does or how it works, but...
It accelerates the web, Ben.
Yeah, apparently it gives you a little toolbar that adds up all of the fractions of seconds you... Never mind.
All right.
Never mind.
Yes.
Google Mars. I haven't been there yet.
Google Mars.
They added the moon. Google Earth, they added the moon. And if you zoom in far enough, then it says
Swiss cheese.
It's Swiss cheese. Yeah.
Of course. That's the truth.
Yeah. That's what the moon's made of.
All right. That was Sean's story. I'm losing track. Let's go back to Miles. Hi, Mr. Elam.
Hi. Researchers at Stanford University School of Medicine have published in the Journal of Psychiatric Research that when they did a functional brain image of 22 young adults, half men, half women, that men's addictive zones react more when playing video games. That there actually is a functional difference between men and women, and that men are biologically predisposed to become addicted to video games, find it harder to put down that controller.
What was the video game content?
I guess the reason
I asked that is it female fighting game and then like, you know, busty women.
From what I understood, it was just a simple video game on a computer screen, just something that they cooked up themselves, probably something on the lines of Super Mario Brothers.
Right, something like that. So both genders
understood the rules of the game, both understood the premises, and yet the guys were more aggressive about playing the game and trying to get better and gaining more territory, and they... could not put it down, the controller down, compared to women.
Interesting. There's so many things that come up with this, and I know that you're not the people that ran the study, but it comes to mind, like, would that be true with any competitive thing, even if it's competitive against another person?
It's just the games are made for...
A lot of them are made
Most
for
of them are.
Some of Didi's...
Maybe if they took a Wii, right? Maybe a Wii is just as addictive to females as it is to males.
No, they were finding
because it's more in line with something they'd be interested in playing. It's kind of built for them too,
right? But they weren't basing it upon a game that's a war simulation or something like that. They were trying to find a fairly gender neutral game, and what they were finding is that young males are 2 to 3 times more likely than females to be addicted to them.
And whether that's a genetic biological thing or if that's a social thing, it's a little unknown. But I'm sure more case studies will come out about this. Thank you very much, Miles.
It's universal nice to hear, we see around the world, though.
It's nice to hear news stories that are more about how the interaction of the game is affecting the person and why they're interested in playing it versus these people, you know, those studies that come out that say video games produce violence or video games reduce violence because these, you know, studies that are always kind of controversial. So it's nice to see a study about that.
Did you hear about the EA announcement with Steven Spielberg? So Steven Spielberg plays the Wii, and he had this great idea for a game, and he went to EA. Of course, he's Steven Spielberg, right? Probably went to the president and said, hey, you know, so-and-so. So, they actually made the game, and it's called Boom Blocks. And you ever play blocks with your kids? You build up the blocks, and you knock them down?
Yes.
Well, it's the same thing, except digital, right? And you use the Wii controller. And it's kind of neat. You could take big sections of blocks to build your castles and so on. But when you knock them down, they're all individual and they fall down and they explode and there's this whole game around it. But if you watch the video,
it's a two-person game where one person tries to play and one tries.
I don't know. You could do anything with this, right? It's such a great idea. I watched the video though, and it looked a lot of fun.
What you need to do is get a computer for River and then get rid of those blocks. Those are just...
Yeah, I know. I don't want her playing with physical blocks.
Yeah, then she'll get all this what called hand-eye coordination stuff, and that's not good.
I don't want that. No. Well, I want her to have quick reflexes and short attention spans.
That's perfect. Yeah. Perfect. That's the kind of person that will succeed in this world.
Oh, this is so bad.
whose turn is it for next news? Sean? Well, Sean's been... Okay, Ben?
Okay, sure. So Nokia and UC Berkeley have an experiment going with 100... Berkeley students with cell phones with GPSs. And so basically on this one day they drove a 10-mile stretch of the 880, I think. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You mean 880?
880. Gosh, you must be from LA.
Oh yeah, the 880.
It's not the 880 here. It's 880.
Fine.
But you know what? People in LA are listening to us.
People are,
and they're saying right now you're wrong. Yeah.
Ben's
right.
You know what? But Ben is sitting up in
Santa Cruz, California.
Central, not northern.
Yeah, we actually are central. We're like the dead center of the state. So
mm-hmm. I said central, didn't I?
20 miles
central
from
coast.
So we're at the demilitarized zone. This is where the battles are fought.
Wait, so all those people with NorCal shirts should have SenCal shirts? Is that right?
Wait, they should have KOSP shirts because it's Central Coast Public Radio. See?
No, yeah. In Southern California, it's CUSP shirts.
Never and now we don't have to worry about any of our audience because everyone's
left. What are these guys talking about?
So on Interstate 880, better. And so they drove this 10-mile stretch, and the phones sent data about the speed and position of each of the cars back to wherever they were, you know.
Some server.
And so they're thinking about using it to track traffic.
It's a great idea.
Because, I mean, if, you know,
it's like SETI.
5% of the people with cell phones have cell phones with GPSs, then all of a sudden people can avoid accidents because they'll know right away, oh, there's an accident. There's a slowdown, you know, 1 mile ahead.
It's one of those technologies I've wanted in cars forever, but of course now we all carry these portable devices that do the exact same thing.
We have cell phones that constantly connect to the cell towers and these data plans, right? Unlimited data. Why not use the processing power of the cell phone to...
And yet,
as long as it somehow hides who the people are, I'm kind of for it. But Ben,
yeah, that's kind of what I was bringing into the idea of, oh, well, if we're using this data for that, then why not use it for...
Yeah, sure. let's think about that. Yeah, there's too
let's
much
track
stuff
Lyle
happen.
As he goes home.
Oh, my gosh. What kind of mind do you have? I wasn't thinking that at all.
Really? You think about how cool it would be?
Let's see. They have this many people that have this type of cell phone going to this area, and half of them are – this goes to a data plan that belongs to a woman, and this belongs to a man. Let's do some marketing research for
– Right. Let's put a billboard on this wall that has to do with this because
Look,
do we have time to talk about
10% of this population goes to the fitness center over there, so we'll put the billboard 10, 20 feet back. And oh, man, it gets
It's
messy.
A slippery slope.
Now, the thing is, with analysis of this sort, you can also then incorporate driving directions so that you fix the problems before they emerge. So, you know, you kind of subscribe to a service where you say, yes, you can use my phone to monitor traffic. And then if some kind of accident or some kind of slowdown is happening, you know, before an intersection of two freeways, your car with GPS system would say, you know what, you should take a right here because – and then it's going to alleviate the problem completely because the traffic flow won't be hitting that spot. It can uncongest and repair itself. So it's pretty –
You can opt in if you want or not.
Also, the people without the cell phones would suddenly see all this, you know, all these vehicles swarming to the right.
And that would be
and
fun.
And like swarm mentality, you know, just follow them because they probably know what they're doing.
Well, that's
you know?
The thing is that the idea would be just do what you're supposed to do. And if you are part of this population that can be managed that way, you're the ones that are going to fix the problem. And so the people that are on the road that don't know about it keep going and the problem never arises.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway. Mm-hmm. Wishful thinking. I just want the flying cars so we can be the future.
Yeah. What happened with that?
It's not the future yet.
It's so funny on Slashdot. That comes up every now and then.
Flying cars?
Yeah. People are just so upset.
Like every month. Yeah. You know, every month there's a story.
It's like, I wanted flying cars when I was a kid. I was promised flying cars.
GeekSpeak is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry, using digital technology for less radiation and offering one appointment crowns and veneers. For appointments and more information, 423-2447. You're listening to GeekSpeak. We're now taking your calls with questions and comments of technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800. Again, 476-2800 or toll-free 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-KUSP. Of course, you can go to geekspeak.org to send us a message.
We genetically alter food. We search the ocean for carbon-gobbling microbes. In the midst of our experiments and our quest for biology's deepest secrets, have we lost sight of the effect we humans have on other species? Join John Hockenberry for the risks and rewards of genetic research on the DNA Files next week on Talk of the Bay from 10 to 11 a.m. on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP.
This is Central Coast Public Radio, KSP. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. That was Sean Cleveland. We also have Ben Jaffe and Miles Elam. And we are all ready to take your calls with questions and comments of technology. Grab a pencil. I'll give those numbers out in just 1 second. Stay with KSP for Castle Cottage this morning at 11 a.m. on Central Coast Public Radio. Geek Speak is supported by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Scotts Valley offering computer rentals, printing, design, shipping, delivered office supplies, notary public, and more. Information is online at businesswithpleasure.com. The phone number is to ask us anything you'd like, 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. And we're going to go ahead and go to our first caller. Hello, and welcome to Geek Speak.
Hello, my name is Kiche. I'm from Capitola.
Well, I didn't catch your name. What is it?
Kiche.
Kiche. Welcome. Yeah. What's your question today?
My question is, I have a HP Pavilion computer, and I'm trying to install Ubuntu.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just having difficulty getting the installation process started. I'm having trouble actually installing it.
Have you gotten the CD to boot Ubuntu?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So that works no problem. And when you say install, is it like giving you a big error, or is it unclear what to do next?
I've tried different processes, but I've never. There's supposed to be an install icon, and I haven't been able to find that. And then a few times, I guess my computer's not recognizing the Ubuntu program.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, are you trying to do this from inside of Windows, or are you booting off of the CD?
I'm in the Windows system right now, and I'm trying to install the Ubuntu right now within Windows.
Okay, so Miles, what do you mean, Miles?
I'm trying to install.
What you're doing is if you install Ubuntu, what you're doing is replacing Windows. So
right,
I don't know that you're going to be installing Ubuntu from within Windows. What you would do is have the CD in the drive, and boot from it.
So the way
you may have to change some BIOS settings. Yeah.
So the way you do that is you're gonna see. I thought the live CD had like a Windows partition on it that mounts, and you can run an application. But
you
can
run open source applications from there. If you put the disk in there, you get things like Firefox and Thunderbird.
But I thought there was an install Ubuntu, which ends reboots your machine off the CD and changes your boot sector. But
perhaps something
here's
new.
The way that here's the way that we've done it.
Okay.
You put the CD in the computer and close it up. And you shut down Windows. Then you boot your machine up again. And when you boot up on your screen, now you said an HP Pavilion. Does anyone know the HP commands to get into BIOS? Sean, you want to make a guess? Delete key to get into BIOS for HP machines?
I think it's F10.
F10?
It'll
and Sean's probably
when the
right.
System starts up, it would
but,
say.
I'm pretty positive it's
okay.
F10.
So when a HP machine boots up, go ahead and hit F10. And then you'll get into this command environment. And you have to kind of look around it. Don't make any changes, but look for quite a while until you find something that says boot up sequence or boot drives, something like that. And in that list is going to be a hard drive.
You
and
know
a
what?
Floppy
you don't need
CD
to do
ROM.
That.
What do you suggest?
There's be a boot. Every modern BIOS has a boot menu capability. So when you first turn your computer on and you see your memory and your processor speed right there on the screen, or you might even see a splash screen that says HP, you know. Right then, if you hit usually it's the F4 key, that brings up a boot menu, and then you can select which device you want to boot from.
Perfect.
So you boot from the CD, and then all of a sudden you're going to see Ubuntu, and you're actually going to be running. And if you then, from in Ubuntu, once you do that on the desktop or on the menu of Ubuntu, there'll be an install thing. And you want to be careful, but basically it should be pretty kind.
So it's F1 for the BIOS screen. F1, Ben just looked it up.
On the BIOS screen.
Yeah, F1. But I wouldn't do that. I would do F4 first to try and get to the boot menu.
Because all you're trying to do is change the boot to CD. And once you're done with this, you want to change it back anyway.
Or when you actually see the post screen, if you hit the pause key, it'll pause the post. And then you can read what's there. And it should tell you what keys to hit.
Good point.
Yeah.
The great thing about this is when you boot off the CD, it won't have changed anything in your hard drive yet, so you'll be able to find out if there's going to be any problems before you take that step that you know, that point of no return. okay. when you're swapping out the operating system.
Okay.
All right.
I'll try that. Thanks, guys.
Thank you very much for the call.
Uh-huh.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. All right. Well, let's go ahead and go to another call from Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Alex, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi. How are you today?
Quite well. What's your question?
Well, my question is, I am a college professor, and I create web pages for my students of my course notes. I type my notes in Microsoft Word, and then I save them as HTML in Microsoft Word and then put them on my web server. When my students look at those using Internet Explorer, they look exactly as I intended them to see it. But when they use Firefox, any of the Greek symbols and characters, many of those get morphed into something else, and then the notes make no sense to my students.
So are there a lot of Greek characters in your work? What's your focus?
Meteorology. I'm a meteorologist.
Okay. All right. This is actually kind of complicated, but first off, have you tried telling them just to use Internet Explorer? I'm sorry.
Yes, I have. The only reason it's an issue is that I know that you guys make a big point about trying to get people off Internet Explorer and using Firefox, and so I've run into this case here where that just doesn't seem to be an option.
Yeah, and what you're doing right now is quite simple because you know Word, and all you have to do is do a save and upload. Miles?
Yes.
But it works in IE. A font is available in IE, but it's not available in Firefox.
It's not a font. It's special character types, I think. Have you seen the CSS styling for Word documents? Man, it's messy. I cringe when you said this, but the problem is I don't have a simple solution for you. I don't know of a good Windows... I don't know of any good editor that will make this very simple for you, where you could like go and paste stuff from Word into something that would then translate into good HTML that would work in Firefox. Just to say that technically, there's no reason Firefox can't render those elements. Miles, do you have a suggestion?
The way I'm still stuck on the, it sounds like certain fonts on a system will have the glyphs for Greek.
I wouldn't think it's a glyph. I wouldn't think it's a font thing.
For it to show up in IE but not in Firefox, that's...
Can you do me a favor? Because I want to research this. I know this kind of seems...
Well, I emailed a link to the web page via email before the show.
Sweet.
So I thought you guys might want to look at it.
You did exactly what I said, what I was thinking. You're amazing. What are you, smart or something as a professor? All right, Miles, so you have to go take a look at what it is about that page that won't work. And let's see, it must be... Oh, look at all this theme song feedback. Web addressed. All right, we're looking at it with Firefox. Looks like there's images in here. Those are working on my computer.
Yeah, the Greek characters and equations that display correctly are because they are equation images that then get rendered, I think, as GIF files in the HTML.
Okay, so down near flux, there are two types of flux. Monochromatic flux, and the formula behind that is that F sub delta colon W dash N. I mean, maybe I'll do a screenshot and email it back, but it looks to me like it's working.
Where it says the monochromatic flux?
Yeah.
Yeah, that should be an F sub lambda.
Oh, it is a lambda. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And after the lambda, what is it supposed to be?
Then it's a W, and then M to the minus 2, and then a micrometer to the minus 1.
It looks good to me.
But I can show you up toward the top of the page where it says, toward the very top where it says wavelength.
Yes.
Where it says wavelength lambda, in parentheses, that should be a lambda.
That's a lambda, isn't it, Miles? Okay, you know what?
I don't see it. This is totally curious,
and I want to work on it, and I don't think the radio is the best time to do it, unfortunately. So what we'll do is, we got the email from you. We'll respond to it. I'll do a screen capture and see if it's the right kind of thing. And maybe it's something other than the browser. Maybe it has to do with the operating system and the font stuff that Miles is talking about.
Okay.
So thank you very much for the call.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Sometimes, just hard to do that on radio. You know what I mean? Well, should we take another call, or do you want to do a news story real quick?
It seems that most people don't like the new song because it doesn't have lyrics.
It has, hey, hey. That's lyrics, isn't it?
Maybe we should have
in other words, we have something that's completely different from every other public radio show out there that we have lyrics in ours, and people don't want us to get rid of it.
People like the lyrics.
Well, listen, there is lyrics in the beginning. Listen. See?
One.
So should we ask the band to add lyrics?
Yeah, maybe Jason would say, you know, geek, speak.
These people are not cool. They're done with it. Something like that. All right.
I'm sure we could work something out.
Yeah, I'm sure. Oh, we just lost network. This is not good, folks. No, we didn't.
No, all right.
Let's
start. It's Justin. Justin the Bean from Justin. Ebu Gogo. That's the band. Ebu, E-B-U, G-O-G-O.
Gogo. With great artwork and a fun, fun
I
music.
Love their artwork.
I do, too.
It's so cool.
Should ask them to redesign their website.
That's pretty cool.
All right. From Watsonville, Judith, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi.
Hi.
I had a suggestion maybe for the last guy who was calling.
Okay.
I don't know whether he could just make his Word documents into PDFs and have them to be able to download from his web pages. So that would come out clear for whoever downloaded it.
It's a good point.
He absolutely could. Because PDF embeds the font no matter what's in there.
Yeah, I think that's a really good solution. It is a pretty complicated paper. I like that idea.
So that was one. And I guess then I had another question that maybe this is on a totally different subject.
Go ahead.
But the TV thing is going to be changing in, you know, to digital broadcasting in, I don't know, in a year or so. And how do you tell if your TV can get digital? If it, like I have a TV that somebody gave me, it was used when it was given to me, but it can get cable TV or the kind of current broadcast TV. If it can get cable, does that mean it can get digital?
Well, how about this? When were you given that TV?
About 2 years ago.
Was it new at that time?
No, it wasn't.
Then the answer is no.
Well, you will need a translator.
You'll need a HD tuner built into the TV to actually take advantage of high definition signals.
Well, it's not. It's a tiny TV, so it's not going to be high def. So I'm talking about.
No, that's the
I'm
thing.
Just, talking
just
about
taking a digital signal? Of course, yeah.
No.
Get any signal.
No,
you
won't.
Need a digital tuner.
When the things switch over, the analog broadcast
that's right.
will
when
stop
they switch
working
over.
And
so
therefore that TV
digital?
Will that TV will be dead.
Well,
no.
Cable companies may still provide the analog signal, so that's actually okay.
That's right.
It's the over-the-air signals that you're not going to get anymore.
In
like,
fact,
you won't
say,
be able to use rabbit ears anymore. Your cable company, it doesn't matter if they send it analog or digitally. It's
well,
as long as the box that's connected to your TV sends it to your television.
So the question is, you have a television. It has a cable in, but
I don't have cable. I just have a big antenna out there.
And what Miles said is correct.
It will not work.
You will not be able to pick up digital signals.
What you'll have to get is another box that will be a digital receiver, which will basically look like a little box with antennas on it that will cost you more money than the TV's worth.
Actually,
and then you plug that into your TV.
Actually, the government is doing a subsidy program to make sure that
that's
it's not expensive.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Try and get a subsidy. I heard about those subsidies, and I thought, well, I wonder if I need to apply.
File for it now.
So when's the switchover happening, 2009?
I can't recall the
date.
Like
beginning
of
next year?
Yeah. As a broadcaster, I don't like it. I don't like the whole idea of it. So even though I'm a geek and everything, I just think that we have this giant infrastructure in here and a mandate to turn off infrastructure like that. I don't have enough faith in the television companies to do better content. I think they're just going to do more of it and it's going to be less quality. And I'm just not convinced.
That is an issue, the quality. Yeah. Because if they take the digital signal and compress it too much, they can fit more content.
Right.
You'll see artifacts. It won't look that great.
I mean, technically, from the good perspective, like I'm assuming, Judith, you get what, three or four stations?
No, I get about five or six. I mean, I get a number of Spanish ones, which I don't watch because I'm not really fluent. But I get probably five or six different ones.
Well, so technically, when we switch over the digital, each of those stations could actually be carrying like two to three. Stations on their bandwidth and so forth, you could technically increase your channel watching quite a bit. But if you've got, do you have a lot of static on any of these channels?
Well, at least three of them come in very clear, or four of them come in very clearly.
So you'll probably lose the other ones completely.
The ones that are not really clear.
Yeah, I think it's probably something we're going to be talking about a lot throughout the year as we get closer to the deadline. How it's going to affect people, how you manage it, and how you handle it.
Because some of them come in sometimes good and not sometimes not good. So.
Right.
I'm concerned I'm going to lose a lot of TV.
I think the thing that upsets me is that this bin solution of, well, we'll just get new tuner boxes, right? So it's a smaller piece of technology. There's not a lot of lead in it, blah, blah, blah. And we'll connect it up and we'll make it work. But the reality is that the new TVs are going to be just cheaper. And so everyone's going to buy a new television in this process. So then we have all this glass with lead in it. And it's a major problem, I think. It's like the definition of, you know, what we always promote on GeekSpeak is reuse the technology before you recycle it, right? Well, if all these TVs, basically you can't reuse them, because you can't use them as receivers. That's kind of frustrating. Anyway, thank you very much for the call, Judith. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Good luck.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And from Hollister, James, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi, how you doing?
Quite well. What's your question today, James?
Well, I was just kind of curious. I had heard just recently on the news that the FCC released the 700 megahertz bandwidth for sale, and it went up for sale, and I guess they call it Block C or something of the frequency range. And there were rumors that Microsoft had bought it or Google had bought it or even Verizon at $1.7 billion. And I'm just kind of curious what kind of ramifications that's going to have on your average consumer and how that's going to open up the Internet to places that are inaccessible at this time.
Because that range, that frequency range of 700 megahertz is lower than the frequency range for typical cell phones today, a lot of the cell phone carriers are looking at it as a way of getting better signal going through walls, being able to have towers further away and still be able to reach the cell phone. And so from that standpoint, it is a good thing for communications. But you are right. The company that was bidding was Google, by the way. At one point, there was going to be a no bid or a public bid from Verizon and other large carriers, and it was seen as a power play to push out any other competition. And Google, I think, has been fighting that and trying to open it up for others. But I don't know if Google actually wants the frequency for itself.
It looked like the way Google was doing the bidding was really trying to have the rules around how that was regulated be a little looser. And specifically, if a company used the bandwidth, they wanted to enforce this idea that if the company used the bandwidth, they couldn't restrict what types of devices went on that bandwidth. And so that's what they're kind of pushing for. But I think it's still kind of in process, right? No one's actually won the bid, and we're still waiting to see what happens.
I believe that's the case, yes.
Actually, the bidding is over, and it went for $1.7 billion, which was like the they said it was going to go for $1.3 billion. So whoever got it obviously really wanted it bad. And I'm kind of curious, is that going to make a monopoly out of that range? Or is that going to, are you going to see other companies benefit from that? I'm just kind of curious how that's going to work. Plus, is that going to open up other devices for consumers to have at that frequency range? That's just kind of my question. Basically.
Yeah, it's an open question.
Yeah, the Block C is what we're talking about, and I believe that the opening bid was 1.2. I don't think it's closed.
Oh, okay. Because I'd read that it actually had closed.
When did you
read
that?
They weren't going to disclose. I read it on Google News and showed it in their business section. So that was probably about 3 days ago.
Uh-huh.
Or maybe even, it's probably been longer, maybe closer to a week. But they had said it had been closed and it ended up at 1.7, but they weren't going to disclose who won it. And that for a guy like me who wants to invest in stocks too, that's also a big important question. If it's Verizon, do I go out and buy Verizon stock? If it's, Google, is that going to bump up their stock over $600 a share? What? So it's kind of an important question, I guess.
Right. Well, thank you very much for the call and the thought process behind it and the information. We'll do, I'm sure one of the geeks right now will do some of the research on whether it's closed or not and what the status is. But thank you so much for the call.
I appreciate it. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Anybody found the story yet?
No, surprisingly little.
All right. Well, we'll take another call, I think. We'll go ahead and go to Falls Church, Virginia. Darren, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hey, how you doing?
Quite well. What's your question today, Darren?
I have a laptop, and I've set the screen resolution, but every time I close the lid, the resolution resets.
Oh, don't close the lid anymore.
Yeah, that works out really well. Makes the laptop useful. Yeah, so.
All right. Thanks. I'm glad we were able to help you.
thanks, guys.
Why is that happening? What kind of laptop is it?
It's an IBM ThinkPad.
Okay. And did this start recently?
It started a couple months ago. It's actually my work laptop. And
is there a good IT department?
I brought it to our IT guys, and they had no idea what's going on.
And they gave you the advice I just gave you.
Yeah.
Perfect.
It resets the resolution?
It resets the resolution. What's the resolution does it reset to?
It resets it to 640 by 480.
So it sounds like something's getting cut off. I don't know. That's weird.
It could be a disconnect kind of thing, and then it's resensing it. Sean, you know a little bit about video. What do you think?
I don't. I'm a motherboard guy. Right. I'm a chip guy.
I wonder, does the same thing happen if you have the laptop open, you change the resolution, and without closing the lid, actually go through a shutdown sequence and then bring it back up again? And
or
see
a sleep
if it keeps
sequence.
Well, the idea is don't close the lid and don't have it suspend or sleep.
Don't put it in a sleep mode,
Put it through an actual operating system shutdown and then bring it back up again and see if it keeps the settings.
Miles is talking about testing. So first off, do a shutdown with the laptop open the entire time and restart and see what happens. And then the other one that Sean's about to suggest.
Do a hibernate.
Yeah, hibernate the machine.
But don't close the lid. And just to see if any of these sleep states are causing the issue.
Yeah, and if it's a software issue like that, it might be fixable by reinstalling the operating system.
BIOS update.
If it only happens when the lid closes, then most likely the video connectors on the motherboard are being disconnected when it closes. Something's being lifted, and that is causing the machine to do a resense, and it's negotiating a 640 by 480 for some reason.
So that's
our recommendation.
And for some reason, when it does this, it also rearranges all the icons on my desktop.
Of course,
get slammed to the upper left corner.
Yeah.
Actually, it seems to have some of them that are locked in place. So maybe there are maybe like a dozen of them that were there when this first started happening. And then everything that I've added since then.
Oh, I know what's going on. Your resolution's not changing. So what's happening is you can actually make your desktop bigger than your notebook, right? And then you could actually move your screen around to those outer areas. So it's not your resolution that's changing. It's just your view of the desktop. So I bet you it's something to do with your graphic settings.
Oh, wait. Could it be a key that's being depressed when it closes on the top that does a zoom?
It could be something like that.
Yeah. It could be that this is a feature that's being triggered incorrectly.
Yeah.
So if you... Just try this. The buttons across the top that normally have function buttons, hit each of them individually and see if this ever happens.
Right. So there's you've got a function key in the on the bottom, right? And then when you hold that down and you hit the function keys across the top, it actually does things to your hardware. And one of those things is you can share your video out to a projector or to a larger monitor with a larger resolution because the chip in your notebook can drive larger resolutions than what's on your notebook. And I think what's happening is it's probably in some mode to do that, and you just need to turn that off.
Okay, well, so
check out your function keys.
On my computer, that's F7, and when I go up there, it has my default display resolution, which it should boot up into. But
the fact that the icons are not moving means that the resolution itself is not changing.
Okay.
It's just your view of the desktop is being reduced.
So you want to look around for some of those features in the laptop that you can zoom in. And also, those keys, there are modifier keys for those as well. Like you can sometimes do different combinations to get the hardware to change in different ways. So play with it a little bit and see if you can find it. And once you find it, you might figure out that something's actually hitting it. I think that's a good guess for us.
So what might be happening is when you close your notebook, it's changing to the resolution that you've specified to go out to another monitor, external monitor.
Yeah.
And then when you open your notebook back up, you're seeing that resolution. It has
sticking.
A switch back. So you need to turn off your...
the auto-sensing of that. What is that under?
So on my notebook, it's the F5 key, and it basically says use the notebook monitor to use both your virtual screen and your main screen. Or, you need to turn off the virtual screen.
Good luck.
All right.
Thank you, Darren, for the call from Virginia.
I wish I had the language around that better, but...
It is a difficult thing to do.
But all notebooks have this capability that you can... Let's say you're giving a PowerPoint presentation and the screen's behind you. Well, you'll want to be able to see your screen, too. So you hit the function mode so that you can see your screen on your notebook, and it outputs to the external screen. So I think what needs to be done is you need to disable the external screen.
Now, earlier we got a call from Hollister about... I'm sorry, no, we got a call from... a professor somewhere, I can't recall where, they called from Lancaster, about...
Langster, Pennsylvania.
Langster, oh, thank you. And about how to deal with the issue. And I think we covered it a bit, but basically a good solution would be if you want a document to look exactly the same online, like you've got strange characters or something, go ahead and make a PDF. And Glenn called and suggested Primo PDF, which is a free writer. It's PRIMO-PDF. And we'll put that on our website, I'm sure, just shortly after the Geek Speak ends, which is about to happen in five minutes or so. So no more calls, unfortunately, today, but one more news story. Who wants it?
But I do want to do a follow-up. It turns out the auction is still in progress.
Oh, great.
And they are at $19.207 billion so far with all the bids around the 50th round of bidding. And
does that force it into the free space? As I recall, there's a whole deal about the C block and the deal with it being open triggered at a certain price rate. Did it cover any of that?
I don't know about that.
So we could talk about some news from the Solid State Circuit Conference.
Thank you, Miles, for that. Okay, what happened in Solid State Conference?
In San Francisco this past week, IBM is shrinking the cell processor to 45 nanometers. That's kind of big because it's going to reduce the price of the PS3, the PlayStation 3. So with the 40 gig model, they had already done this. They shrank it down to 65 nanometer, mm-hmm. and it actually reduced the power and heat generation of the PS3. And it's people noticed this, and they didn't even announce it. People said, wait a minute, what's going on with this? So they're shrinking it to 45 nanometer, which should reduce the power consumption of the PS3 another 40%. And the die size by 34%. So I guess Sony just made their first money, because right now it costs about $400 to make one of these consoles. And so only the top-end consoles they're making money off right now.
But wasn't the Xbox 360 the one with the heat problems?
Well, it was the brick, and those have been fixed. It was the actual... So you got to understand that the power supply is not in the unit. It's in the big brick outside the unit, mm-hmm. and that's what's heating up. Yeah, when they first launched, they recommended to float it in the air so it gets more... it cools off. You know, maybe don't put it on the floor. Yeah, that was fixed. So, but Activision came out and forecast that Xbox 360 was going to outsell the PS3 in 2008.
And?
Which is interesting. So they expect that the Wii will sell 6 million units, the Xbox 360 anywhere from 4 to 5 million, the PS3 somewhere between 3 and 4 million, and the PS2 still selling 2 to 3 million units.
Wow.
So, you know, it's a long-term thing.
Yeah.
Which is why they're so great when they first come out, but... You know, after 5 years, that the PC and is just so far ahead, right?
Yeah,
because these things are just getting their legs.
And
is there more? There's more.
Yeah,
more chip news.
Well, I got one more thing on the 700 megahertz C block receives. So it looks like the minimum bid of $4.6 billion was required to trigger an open access rule, which allowed any mobile device and software applications to use that spectrum, no matter what the carrier was. So there's a regulation in place now, because we've gone over that point, that this spectrum will be open access in some way.
Thank you, Google.
Yeah, thank you, Google, for setting that up, and it worked great. I'm surprised it's at $19 billion.
So we might see cell phones that have free service if Google gets what they want, right?
It's a possibility.
And they just want you to see their ads.
There are multiple blocks there, and $19.2 billion refers to all the blocks together in total.
Right.
So,
all right. The Geeks this morning were Miles Elam, Sean Cleveland, and Ben Jaffe. Thank you, Geeks, for being here today.
Yeah,
pleasure to be here as always.
And thank you for listening to Geek Speak. Without you, it would just be us geeking out alone, our basement sad, crying. So thanks for making us public. GeekSpeak is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. Tune in for This American Life Sunday morning at 10 a.m. on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. Broadcasting in HD radio on 88.9 FM, this is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Arto, streaming live and podcasting at KUSP.org. For any more information about this episode of GeekSpeak, you're welcome to go up to our website, geekspeak.org, and click on today's show, which is, what day is today? The 9th?
9th
of February, 2008. Thanks so much for listening. I'll be here next week. This is Lyle Troxell, signing off. You just listened to another episode of GeekSpeak via our podcast. Would you do us a favor? Please go to your favorite podcasting index site, whether it be iTunes, Dig.com, Odeo, or another site, and write a review or give us a vote to let others know what you think about GeekSpeak. Thanks, that'd really help us out. GeekSpeak is supported by PreownedCar.com, PreownedCar.com, where anyone can post their vehicle for sale or browse to purchase a pre-owned car from other car owners. More information available at PreownedCar.com. This is Lyle Troxell for KUSP. Thanks for listening.